Faye, it's that time of year again. This episode's coming out right after match day, so congratulations to all of you who just matched into the best specialty ever.
Yes, congratulations to all of you who are matched into OBGYN, and we know that sometimes, even after the match, we may be a little bit anxious about starting intern year.
Yes, so for the last several years, Faye, myself, as well as a team of really excellent individuals have come up with the hashtag OBGYN Intern Challenge residency preparatory curriculum delivered via text message once a day for a month leading up to intern year.
Yes, so if you want to get signed up for the OBGYN Intern Challenge, go to www.obgyninternchallenge.com where you can go ahead and sign up, do our survey, and this will get you set up for our text message course later on in the year.
We'll see you for the curriculum. Faye, it feels really nice to be back and recording podcasts again after parental leave, but you know, even 6 weeks later, I feel like I have missed a whole world of things in OBGYN.
Yeah, me too, especially 9 weeks out. But thankfully for us, we can refresh our memory with the OBG project.
That's right. The OBG project kind of has their great, great summaries and these bullet point formats online. They've got resident exclusive resources, the core curriculum, and they've got a new project in the primary care med project. You can check that out as well, which lets you get up to date with all those primary care guidelines that we got to keep up with too.
And even better, if you're a resident, remember that you can get OBG First absolutely free. So if you want to figure out how to do that, go ahead and go onto our website, click on the sidebar, and link to the OBG project. All right, guys, welcome back. This is Faye.
This is Nick.
And this is
Kriogs over coffee.
All right, guys. Today we have a very exciting guest with us. We have Dr. Luke Burns, who is an OBGYN who graduated from residency at the University of Michigan in 2022 and was an OB hospitalist there for a year, and now moving to the University of Chicago and Endeavor Health, where he is a first-year MFM fellow. Welcome, Luke.
Thank you, Nick and Faye, for having me on Kriogs Over Coffee. I've been a huge fan of you guys ever since residency, and I definitely credit you with some responsibility for helping me pass not just my Kriogs, but my aura boards last year. So thank you very much for that.
No, well, thank you, Luke, for being a friend of the show and being a listener. And unfortunately, no relationship between us, despite the shared last name, other than the, you know, collegial professional relationship. But, you know, one of the things that I think you are going to talk with us about today is a little bit of a departure for our show. Rather than talking about, you know, the latest writing or the latest sort of thing, we're going to kind of take a step back. Is that right?
That's definitely right. So I've always been interested in really understanding why we do certain things in certain ways in obstetrics. Because, you know, we have these guidelines that we use when we're studying for our shelf exams, for our USMLE step exams, of course, for Kriogs too. But so often we're medical students and residents, we never really get a chance to question the dogma. We're running from patient to patient. We're applying these algorithms and protocols, but we never really understand why we're doing them. So today, I kind of wanted to open up a conversation that I'm calling Why We Do the Things the Way We Do in Obstetrics.
Well, that's really great, Luke, and I'm excited to hear about the topic today. So what are you going to talk to us about?
Personally, I'm really interested in preeclampsia, and so I thought I'd start with that topic. Our learning objectives today will be first to review the history of preeclampsia and hypertensive disease in pregnancy. We'll understand why we pick a blood pressure of 140 over 90 as a cutoff for hypertension. And then finally, we'll understand how these cutoffs might change in the future because of recent data that suggests that tighter blood pressure controls may be actually yielding better outcomes. So I'll start by saying that all the interns and a lot of the medical students who are listening today will have already memorized those thick cardinal severe features of preeclampsia, which are severe range blood pressures, thrombocytopenia, kidney injury, pulmonary edema, liver dysfunction, and any form of cerebrovascular dysfunction.
Yeah, that's right. And again, if you hearken back to one of our old podcasts or the practice bulletin, or I guess now clinical practice guidelines related to hypertension, we've all learned that it takes just one of those severe features to earn the patient a diagnosis of preeclampsia with severe features.
I think as many of your listeners know, it's never easy. It's never that straightforward. Like, what if the patient has like an unremitting headache, but we know they have a history of migraines? Or that classic MFM scenario where they have a history of lupus and then they have a newly elevated creatinine, and maybe that could be a lupus flare, or could that be new preeclampsia? It gets really complicated.
Yeah, and of course, there's that common situation that I think we've all come across, which is the patient who has a history of chronic hypertension, and now they have newly severe range blood pressure. So is that just like an exacerbation of the chronic hypertension, or is this actually superimposed preeclampsia, right?
Right. And nothing is clear cut in our field. I think that's a self-criticism that we always apply to ourselves. But I kind of want to take a step back from severe preeclampsia and just focus on one element now, which is pregnancy-induced hypertension. And specifically, the blood pressure cutoffs that we use to diagnose preeclampsia, gestational hypertension, and chronic hypertension. So can you guys remind me again, because I've forgotten momentarily, what the cutoff range is for just regular hypertension and preeclampsia?
So yeah, absolutely. So a systolic blood pressure of 140 or higher, a diastolic blood pressure of 90 or higher, both of those things, and then you need to have them on two occasions at least 4 hours apart.
Right. Good job, Dr. Burns. I'm glad you remember that from medical school. My curiosity, though, is why did we pick those numbers? Because they just sound so arbitrary.
Well, I'm assuming that it has something to do with the history of preeclampsia and something about when doctors and midwives first recognized it as a disease, but I hope you could educate us, Luke.
I would love to. So yeah, our knowledge of preeclampsia actually goes back millennia. We have these ancient Egyptian texts from 1800 BC written in like hieroglyphic text that describe seizures in nulliparous patients. So this is kind of our first written record of doctors and healers and midwives who diagnosed preeclampsia as a disease that was unique to pregnant people. And in fact, we get the name eclampsia from the word Greek, eclampsis, which means a sudden shining out.
Yeah, I guess that works really nicely as the lightning strike of describing that severe event of the seizure, huh?
Right, exactly. And it wasn't really until the 19th century, obviously many, many millennia later, that a Scottish doctor made the association between seizures, hypertension, and proteinuria. So at first, doctors thought that preeclampsia might be caused by some kind of external force, like toxins or poisons, or even a bacterium that they called Bacillus eclampsiae.
Oh, that's interesting that preeclampsia could be caused by a bacteria to them.
Right. And it turned out they were actually growing a bacteria when they were sampling this, but that bacteria was just Proteus, a Proteus vulgaris. So by the 19th century, many researchers were desperate. They really wanted to find some kind of external force that was causing preeclampsia in their patients who were getting really, really sick. So some physicians had actually retransfused postpartum preeclamptic patients with their own blood that they obtained when they were still pregnant, but they give it to them after delivery. And they would see this hypertensive response in these postpartum patients like a week or two later. So they thought maybe they found this mysterious toxin that they were re-injecting into their patients that was causing preeclampsia.
Yeah, and I guess that makes sense historically. You know, one of the things that I even remember from being a medical student was having patients or the parents of patients or even some old-time docs refer to preeclampsia as like the toxemia of pregnancy.
Right, exactly. I heard the same thing. But what these physicians were really seeing was probably the effect of something else, something like an angiogenic preeclamptic protein, like the famous one being SFLT1 that some of your listeners have probably heard of. And I'm sure that's something that you guys will hope you'll cover in a future episode too.
Yeah. So I guess, you know, Luke, how did these physicians and researchers end up coming with those guidelines for blood pressures for preeclampsia?
Right. So for most of the 20th century, nobody could really decide what the blood pressure cutoff should be for pregnant patients with preeclampsia. And then in the 1940s, an organization that was called the American Committee on Maternal Welfare, or the ACMW, they published their own definition of preeclampsia. And so the ACMW were kind of like a precursor to ACOG, and they comprised a really small committee of leading U.S. physicians who kind of self-elected themselves. And by general consensus, this small group of physicians, they somewhat arbitrarily came up with a definition for preeclampsia blood pressures that we still use today. And that's that cutoff that Nick told us about for 140 millimeters mercury for systolic blood pressures and 90 millimeters mercury for diastolic blood pressures.
And I assume then we just lived happily ever after with that, right?
No, not even close. So in 1952, the chair of OBGYN at the University of Chicago, William J. Diekman, he wrote a textbook called The Toxemias of Pregnancy. There's that word toxemia again. And because he was this big shot expert in this field and kind of a big deal, everyone took his word for it that 140 over 90 should be the cutoff for preeclampsia. Even though when he published this textbook, he provided no evidence for this beyond it being, quote, general consensus.
Oh, that's very interesting. So I guess, you know, we've talked about the blood pressures, but where does that proteinuria come in as part of the diagnosis?
Yeah, so he thought proteinuria should be part of the diagnosis, and he agreed that 300 milligrams of protein over a 24-hour period for 3 days was diagnostic. Again, he didn't really explain where he got this threshold from. And remember, this definition, which is essentially the same one or pretty similar to the one that we use today, was devised more than 80 years ago.
Well, I have to imagine that folks have tried to change the definition since then.
They have, yeah. There have been dozens and dozens of conflicting definitions. And every decade, it seems like ACOG has made some slight amendments. And that's something I really want to stress, just how mercurial this definition of preeclampsia has been over the last couple of centuries. Often when people tried to create more nuanced definitions, though, they were shouted down by others who thought that allowing physicians and midwives any judgment might lead to inconsistencies in the diagnosis of preeclampsia. The emphasis always seemed to be on keeping things just as simple as possible. With that in mind, do you guys remember a famous obstetrician named Dr. Friedman?
Yeah, sure. So Emanuel Friedman, who made the Friedman curve, which is a partogram and kind of an antiquated way to look at the patient's labor course, right?
He's the one, the famous Dr. Friedman. Well, in 1976, he was at Harvard with a colleague, and they decided that they were fed up with these arbitrary definitions of preeclampsia that were made around these blood pressures that weren't really consistent. And so published this book called Pregnancy Hypertension. And they used data from a big study with over 38,000 pregnancies over a 20-year course. And they looked at the average blood pressure of all the pregnant patients in this cohort. And they realized that fetal mortality was significantly greater if a patient's diastolic blood pressure was over 85 millimeters when there was proteinuria, or over 95 millimeters whether there was proteinuria or not.
So, I mean, that's kind of interesting, especially when we think about this with modern times. So stillbirth was more likely if you had a diastolic blood pressure of 85 with protein or 95 without protein. It sounds like maybe you could make a good argument and just split the difference there. Is that kind of what happened?
That's exactly what ACOG did. So along with some other big organizations, ACOG took the diastolic cutoff for hypertension and made it 90 millimeters of mercury. That's because it's right in the middle of 85 and 95. And that's a value that was determined by a study from more than 50 years ago. So for a long time, diastolic blood pressures were seen as a much better predictor of perinatal outcomes than systolic blood pressures. We get the 140 millimeter for systolic blood pressures basically because it's convention, and we've been using it since the 1950s.
Wow. So I guess the next question then is, how have our definitions for pregnancy-induced hypertension changed since, you know, Friedman's study?
They haven't really changed all that much. So in the early 2000s, ACOG had scrapped the idea that rapid changes in blood pressure could be a diagnostic of hypertension. And then in 2013, ACOG stated that proteinuria was not really a necessary precursor for severe preeclampsia. But other than that, the definition hasn't really changed at all. And if you look at ACOG practice bulletin number 222, which was published in 2018, you'll see that ACOG bases its recommendations for a cutoff of 140 millimeters mercury over 90 millimeters mercury on findings from a document that was published in 2000 by the National High Blood Pressure Education Program Working Group, which in turn came from a consensus report released in the late 80s. And so I'm kind of following line back, but if you read this old report from the 80s, and I have read it, among the 16 pages that you find one little paragraph about pregnant women and no mention at all of blood pressure recommendations.
So I guess, Luke, you as a MFM fellow here are trying to propose a new study to look at our consensus definitions once again and re-examine how we diagnose hypertension. Is that what I'm hearing, that ABOG should be ready for this thesis in a couple of years?
Yeah, I might not be leading the charge on that, but I certainly would support it if someone else did. Basically, I think a lot of the Kriegs of a coffee listeners probably know that we've already started trying to re-examine how we treat blood pressures and how we diagnose them in pregnancy. In non-pregnant patients, they've been doing this for a while. Back in 2017, the American Heart Association redefined stage one hypertension among non-pregnant patients as 130 millimeters mercury over 80 millimeters mercury. And it's clear that patients with tighter blood pressure control since then seem to have better long-term cardiovascular outcomes.
Yeah, and in the CHAP trial, which came out in 2022, they found something similar. So patients with chronic hypertension who maintained tight blood pressure goals less than 140 over 90 were significantly less likely to meet the primary composite outcome of severe preeclampsia, abruption, medically indicated preterm birth than those who had that higher cutoff of 160 over 110.
That's right. And a subgroup analysis of that same cohort published just last December found that patients with blood pressures that were even better controlled, with a mean systolic blood pressure less than 130 systolic and diastolic less than 80, had significantly lower risks of severe preeclampsia or preterm birth than those from the original study who were controlled to less than 140 over 90.
So would you say that the definitions for pregnancy-induced hypertension are about to change again?
Oh, remember, the CHAP trial looked at patients with chronic hypertension, not preeclampsia. So it's hard to really extrapolate directly. But if the history of preeclampsia definitions in the U.S. are anything to go by, nothing appears to be set in stone.
Well, that was definitely a fascinating review of the diagnosis of hypertension in pregnancy, Luke. And it sounds like there is a lot more left for us to kind of figure out in this realm.
Yep, and that is something I love about our field. It's part of the reason why I chose an MFM fellowship. We get rewarded for peeking behind the curtain and asking, why do we do this thing that we do? And then asking, could we do it even better?
Well, yeah, I love this approach to podcasting, Luke, and kind of, again, taking a peek behind the curtain, as you say, to just do something a little different and to, again, ask the why behind what we do. So we appreciate you coming on the show and sharing this with us. This was fascinating.
It was a real honor, guys. Thank you so much for having me.
All right, guys. So once again, this is Nick.
This is Faye.
And this has been Creogs Over Coffee. So guys, if you enjoyed the podcast, head over to iTunes, Spotify, Google Play, whatever your podcatcher is. Give us a 5-star rating and review.
You can find us on social media on X at Creogs Over Coffee 1, on Facebook and Instagram at Creogs Over Coffee. And if you want to donate to the show, go ahead and go over to our Patreon at www.patreon.com/Creogs Over Coffee.
You can find show notes for this episode and all of our previous episodes on our website, creogsovercoffee.com.
And if you want to reach out to us, have a question about the show, have ideas for an episode or a correction for us, go ahead and email us, creogsovercoffee@gmail.com.